Okay, right, so from now on, low redshift is going to be z equals 6. So I'm going to talk about reionization, and I'm going to start off by giving a brief overview, very brief overview, and sort of motivate what I want to talk about, which is the topology of reionization, by which I mean the distribution of neutral and ionized gas. I'm going to describe a model for that, and then a whole bunch of probes that I think over the next few years will allow us to actually constrain it, and I'll finish by describing the instrument I'm involved in, which is the Mellura wide field array. Okay, so with this audience, I don't think I need to convince you that reionization is important. It's the hallmark event of the first sources of light. So I want to just say there are basically three things that we want to know about it. The first is when it happened, which tells you something, sort of some integrated constraint on when those sources became important. The second is why, by which I mean what were the sources that were actually responsible for the event. And the third is how did those sources interact with the IGM around them and cause it to be ionized. So right now, the current state of the field is just trying to answer that first question of when. And there are a whole bunch of constraints, which I've summarized here kind of crudely. And I don't want to go into them. I just want to say that this is usually taken to mean that the history is complex, that there's some feedback process that's going on that's changing the sources as you go forward in time. That complexity is really interesting, and it tells you a lot about the sources. But even if that's not there, if these feedback processes turn out not to be so important, at any one time, reionization is spatially complex. We have neutral and ionized gas, and we want to understand how that distribution got there, because that's really what's going to tell us about what the sources are doing. Okay, so can we understand what that topology is? Okay, the simple, usual way people think about these things is you have a bunch of galaxies in the high redshift universe, and they're distributed around, and they each have ionizing photons. So they each make a little H2 region around themselves. And when the mean size of an H2 region equals the mean distance between the sources, the H2 regions overlap, and you get reionization. Okay? I think that's sort of the picture that underpins most of our thinking about reionization and this whole overlap process. But if you go to this numerical simulations, that's really not what's happening. Okay, so this is an example from Aaron Sakasian. Here, the green stuff is neutral gas, and the blue stuff is ionized gas. And if you go back very early in reionization up here, you can see that you don't have a whole bunch of little H2 regions distributed around. You have a couple of big ones. And those couple of big ones slowly grow until they overlap. Okay, and that's very different from this classical picture. So the question is, why is that happening? Well, in this plot, these dark, very dark spots up here, for example, those are the galaxies. Okay, so what's happening is that the galaxies are highly clustered early in reionization, even early in reionization. Okay, so their H2 regions overlap very quickly, and then those clusters of sources have H2 regions that shoot out into the IGM and overlap and merge. Okay, there is some evidence for this kind of large-scale inhomogeneity in the data already. So these are the two highest redshift Sloan quasars, 1030 and 1148, and the point I just want to make is that these are extremely different. Okay, the first one to be discovered, nothing there, it's completely black, Gunns-Peterson trough, blah, 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 blah. But the second one to be discovered, that there's this Lyman alpha spike, all right, in between two apparent troughs. And if you go to Lyman beta, there's all these features right here, okay, which is, on 100 Comey megaparsec scale, different from this. All right, so we want to understand, what is that telling us about reionization and the high redshift universe? So the fact that the topology is driven by clustering of sources is actually good, because we understand those large-scale density fluctuations pretty well. So we can construct a model to actually describe those H2 regions, right? And let me just run through how we did that. So I make the very simple assumption that the mass that any galaxy can ionize in the IGM is proportional to its own mass, okay, with some efficiency factor zeta. And zeta encapsulates a whole lot of things about which we have no idea, but just for now take it to be a free parameter. So then we can ask the question, we can identify some region in the IGM, and we can ask whether it's ionized or not, okay? And it's a very easy question to answer, because we just go inside and we count the number of galaxies. And if the mass in galaxies, the fraction of the mass in galaxies is greater than, the mass of the region divided by the zeta, then we're in business and we're ionized. Right? That sounds great. There are a couple of problems with actually applying it, though, to get the entire topology of reionization. Right? The first one is, how did I know to choose a region of this exact size? Okay, I could have specified this smaller region here. I would look inside, I would see a galaxy, I would say it's ionized. But I would have put it, in the wrong size of a region. Okay, and even more seriously, what if I had taken this region up here? Okay, there's no galaxies inside, right? But we know it's ionized by its neighbors. Okay, Fortunately, there's a very nice way to deal with this, and those of you who are aficionados of the excursion set formalism will recognize this. What you do is you pick your point, okay, and you draw a really big sphere around it, and you ask whether this condition is fulfilled. Okay, if it's not fulfilled, you draw a slightly smaller sphere, and you keep making the sphere smaller until your condition is fulfilled. Okay? In that way, you're working from big to small, and so you're automatically sort of dynamically choosing the correct size of the H2 region. And you're also incorporating including all the neighbors by, again, working from big to small. And this is exactly the same thing you do to make the mass function of dark matter halos in the Presch-Schechter formalism. Okay, you're just using a different condition than the density. So you can do that, and you can see what it gets, and here it is. All right, so this is the function of the co-moving radius of the region. It's the fraction of ionized mass in bubbles of a given size. And the different curves are for different stages in reionization, from 4% ionized to 75% ionized. All right? And what you see happening is that very early on, the bubbles are small. Okay? If you're sufficiently early, there are so few galaxies that they're isolated. Right? And on the right here, I'm plotting most of the curves are the same as over here. The thin dotted curves are what you would get if you just had isolated galaxies randomly placed throughout the universe. All right? So early on, this green curve and this green curve aren't too different. Right, so galaxies are mostly isolated. But once you get to the middle of reionization, which is this curve right here, the characteristic size is several co-moving megaparsecs. Okay, that's many, many times larger than you get from an individual galaxy. And by the time you're 75% of the way through, you're at 20 co-moving megaparsecs. Right, these things are absolutely enormous.
What are you assuming for the minimum mass object?
I'm assuming 10 to the 4 K virial temperature, but it really doesn't matter very much. Okay, so there are three take-home messages from this part of the talk. The first is these things are big, okay? And that's good news in general because big things are easier to observe. The second is not only are they big, but they have a characteristic size. There's a peak to this function. And that peak is basically determined by what an average piece of the universe is doing. So this is a overdensity of zero. These are slightly overdense, and these are slightly underdense regions, okay? And so it translates into this characteristic scale. Again, hopefully that's easy to observe. The third message is all of the simulations of reionization that have been done so far are done in boxes that, the biggest one that I know of at least, is 20 megaparsecs, 20 H inverse megaparsecs big. Most of them are 10 or smaller. Now, by the time you're 75% of the way through reionization, an average part of the universe should already be ionized, but it should have a bubble that's the same size as your simulation box. Okay, so obviously by choosing a finite size, you're biasing things to be too small, and you're affecting the process itself. So I really don't think we can reliably interpret existing reionization simulations. Okay, we need much bigger boxes in order to do the late stages of overlap properly.
Steve, how does the particular x-axis depend on the values 80 to 40? What if you're taking 250 or...
It actually doesn't matter. It's basically determined only by where in reionization you are. It depends slightly on the redshift through the bias of the sources, but that's all. It's almost invariant.
Well, I'll tell you what isn't invariant. That's where I'm puzzled. When the overlap occurs, can't be invariant. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter how...
No, I'm saying if you change zeta, okay, you're moving this black curve back and forth in time, but if you fix the neutral fraction to be 25%, then that curve almost always looks pretty similar to that.
The same physical scale.
The same co-moving scale. Okay, so the remaining question is what is setting that particular characteristic size? And at least one important factor is the bias, the clustering of the sources, as I suggested earlier. So in this plot, the solid curves are the same as on the previous slide. The dashed curves are a similar model, except I've taken that efficiency factor to increase with the halo mass. Okay, so you're weighting the larger galaxies more, you're increasing the mean bias of the ionizing sources, and you make the bubbles bigger. Okay, and early on, it's a factor of a few, and late, it's about a factor of two. And so that's just one example of how the physics of the sources and the IGM affects the topology. You also have to worry about things like clumping and recombinations in the IGM, which I've included only very crudely. And you have to worry about those feedback mechanisms that are making things temporally complex. Right? That's obviously going to manifest itself at any one time as well. So given, I hope I've convinced you that this is an interesting question to try and answer, how do we do that? Right? And there are a variety of probes that you can look for. And these are, I just want to go through each of them quickly in sort of order of increasing exoticness. So we'll start with the quasar spectra again. This is the J1148 spectrum, the one with the interesting features in it. And just the question to ask is, can these kinds of transmission spikes tell you about the topology of reionization? Right. The if we go back to the classical picture of reionization where galaxies are more or less isolated and antisocial, so we have some galaxy sitting right here, it makes a little H2 region around itself. Right? And suppose we have a quasar sitting between us, or this is sitting between us and a quasar, what would we see in the spectrum? Well, in order to get transmission at, say, this point, we need to satisfy two things. First, at that exact point, we need the residual neutral fraction to be very small. Okay? You can always satisfy that by going close enough to a galaxy. But we also have, say, a photon that's redshift, that it's at the Lyman alpha resonance right here. As it travels towards us, it redshifts. Okay? And when it hits the edge of the H2 region, if it's still close to the line center, right, it's hitting neutral gas and it's in the damping wing, it's going to be absorbed. Right? So if these H2 regions are small, then it won't have redshifted very much between the center and the edge. It'll still be in the damping wing. It'll get absorbed. So Renan Barkana calculated what kind of transmission features you expect in a picture like that. And essentially, you see nothing at all before reionization. It's impossible to get galaxies big enough to get transmission, to kill that damping wing. But okay, if now that we have this model where the H2 regions are many, many times bigger, right, then obviously if a photon is in the Lyman alpha resonance here, by the time it gets all the way out here, it's way out in the wings of the line, and you don't get that damping wing absorption. Right? So in fact, in this kind of picture, you can get transmission even before reionization is complete. And here's a very simple model where I calculated how much you should get. So as a function of the Lyman alpha optical depth, these are the number of transmission spikes per unit redshift you get with an optical depth less than some value. Okay? And the four different curves are for different stages of reionization from 75% to 90% ionized. Right, and this solid curve is the Lyman alpha transmission spike in that spectrum I showed earlier, just to show you that we really can observe things like that. And what you find is you get of order, you know, one per delta Z of 2 or 3. Right, so you don't get a lot of these features before reionization, but you should get some. And if we can get a larger sample of quasars, we can start to look for these. You know, and when they start to disappear, we'll tell you sort of when the bubbles start to get small. Unfortunately, right now, actually interpreting what a given transmission spike tells you depends on like the distribution of ionizing sources and the density distribution of the IGM, and it's actually tough to theoretically interpret the data right now. I think that's something we need to work on. The second constraint comes from galaxies. Okay, so again, this is pretty much the same picture. If we have our antisocial galaxy over here by itself, suppose it produces some Lyman alpha photons from intrinsic processes. Okay. Those photons will travel through the H2 region. They'll be redshifted. When they hit the edge of the H2 region, if they're still in the wings in the center of the line, they'll get absorbed. Right? So if you have small bubbles, then you don't see Lyman alpha photons from galaxies before reionization. Of course, if you have big bubbles, then they redshift quite a bit more by the time they hit that neutral gas. They don't get absorbed. And so you do end up with some residual Lyman alpha flux. Right? So if we had some sample of galaxies out there, okay, and we could look at, you know, the distribution of Lyman alpha fluxes, then you can measure the distribution, something about at least the distribution of the H2 regions that they're in. Right? We don't have that yet. It's hard to select galaxies at high redshifts just based on continuum properties. So what we do actually is select them based on their Lyman alpha lines themselves. Okay? So if you're post-reionization, obviously lots of galaxies will have Lyman alpha line photons. As you go farther back in time, they suffer more absorption and they should disappear, and these surveys shouldn't work anymore. Right, so what Malhotra and Rhodes did last spring was they had a sample of Lyman alpha galaxies at redshift 5.7 and at redshift 6.5, and they compared the numbers. Right, and they found that basically there are as many at 6.5 as there are at 5.7. Right, and formally they said that the number density decreases by no more than a factor of 3 or so. All right, so if we pretend that this thick black line is our intrinsic luminosity function, what they said you could rule out was the thin blue line, thin black line. Right? So now what I've done is I've taken our galaxies, okay, according to this luminosity function, and I just put them in the bubbles according to our model, right? And I've done it for different neutral fractions. So this blue line is for 75% ionized, 50%, and 25% ionized. Right, so what you find is that very late, the bubbles are huge, there's no absorption, you get almost no change. But as you go to the universe being about 50% ionized, you start to get a real decrease in the number density, right? And that'll vanish pretty rapidly. So this Malhotra and Rhodes argument is telling us that at redshift 6.5, the universe is no more than 50% ionized, right? But it also tells us that we ought to be able to find these things, you know, back to when the universe is sort of in the middle of reionization. And if we can do that, if we can push these Lyman alpha selected surveys up to redshift 8 or so, then we can actually start to constrain the history of reionization together with the topology, because the topology is determining how fast this is falling. All right. The third constraint I want to talk about is the CMB. Being a cosmologist, I feel compelled to mention the CMB at some point. Okay, so the constraint is basically the secondary anisotropy from what's called the kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, which is if you have the CMB photons propagating through ionized gas, they get scattered, and if the ionized gas has some peculiar motion, then either they get redshifted or blue-shifted, right? And there are two parts to this, basically. There's the nonlinear kinetic Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, which is also called the Ostriker-Vishniak effect, which is basically determined by nonlinear structure formation. And as such, it's dominated by the low redshifts, because that's where most of the nonlinear structures are. But it depends slightly on when you start to ionize things. Okay, so it depends somewhat on the reionization redshift. The more interesting contribution is from what's called patchy reionization, where you have some velocity flow, which you've ionized part of it, but not the rest. Right? And so you get the scattering in part of the flow, and you don't get the other part. And that's important because if you had to linear order, this thing basically cancels out. So you need to only ionize part of your velocity field. All right, so what Matt McQuinn has done is to use the model that I described to calculate the patchy reionization contribution from different reionization histories. Okay, so here are four different ionization histories, all right, and these are the angular power spectrum from the patchy contribution. Okay, and basically what you find is they peak at a few tens of arc minutes, and if you add in the Ostriker-Vishniak effect, okay, and the primordial anisotropies, you get these curves up here, right, which look quite similar. But in this blow-up, these error bars are the expected error bars from the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is going to be built in 3 years from now. And so you can see that these error bars are actually incredibly tiny. I'm amazed by it. And so you can differentiate these different histories just based on their patchy reionization contribution. Now, to learn about the topology, you want to do more than just look at, you know, when it happened. All right. So for an example of what you could learn, we played with some extended reionization models where we have some first generation of sources that partly reionizes you, and then they shut off, and you basically get this stalling phase that persists for a while until some second generation kicks in and finishes the job. Right? When you have this long stalling phase, then you're increasing the time span over which you have the patchiness. Right? So you drastically increase the signal, right? And you make it almost trivial for these experiments to disentangle the different patchy contributions. Right, so I think this is a promising technique to at least, you know, grossly discriminate between how long the extended patchy reionization is lasting. But the problem with the CMB is that it's, you know, there's one CMB and it's integrating, it's traveling through the entire history of the universe. So you're getting some integrated constraint. If we want to get the entire history, we need to do something different. And that something different is 21 centimeter tomography. So the idea has been around for 30 years. Basically, if you have lots of neutral gas before reionization, all the hydrogen is going to have the 21 centimeter transition. And so you just image it all in that transition. Okay, and because hydrogen is everywhere, you can look at the whole sky, get enormous volumes. And because it's a line transition, you can separate it in redshift space and get the entire history of reionization. So just as an orientation exercise, here's the kind of map you could do if you could do these experiments. This is a slice from a simulation. It's 13 megaparsecs across, which is about 5 arc minutes on the sky. And it's 2 megaparsecs thick. The intensity scale here is just the flux in the line. Okay. Right now, the ionizing sources haven't turned on yet. So you're just seeing the fluctuations here from the cosmic web starting to form. Okay. As we step forward in time, the contrast increases because the cosmic web is getting the densities are increasing. And at redshift 12, the first ionizing sources turn on, and they blow these big H2 regions into the universe around them. And the interesting thing to see is that really this is what's dominating your map. Okay, you're not so much caring about the density fluctuations as you are between the huge contrast between the totally ionized and the totally neutral stuff. All right, so if we could make these kinds of maps, then we'd have a, you know, the ultimate history of reionization. To put some numbers on it, the problem is that the mean light, this is an extremely weak transition. The mean lifetime is 30 million years. Okay, so rather than have the 100,000 optical depth that we have for Lyman alpha, we have something like 1%. And if you translate that into flux, which I'm going to talk about in millikelvin, it's around 20 millikelvin. Right? And it depends on three things. The neutral fraction and the density, both of which we really want to measure to understand reionization. And then the temperature factor that is telling you how much the universe is emitting or absorbing against your CMB backlight. Now, that can in principle be complicated, but during reionization, it's tough to imagine this temperature not being large compared to the CMB. In that case, this factor just goes away and we can ignore it. And so for what I'm going to show you, I did that. All right. So it would be great if we could go out and we could make maps like I just showed you. The problem is the frequencies we're working at, the sky is very noisy. So the rest frequency is 1.4 gigahertz. You redshift that by a factor of 10 or so, and you're around 100 megahertz. At 100 megahertz, the galactic synchrotron emission has a brightness temperature of between 200 and 2,000 Kelvin. Right? So four or five orders of magnitude bigger than this signal. And that just completely swamps you. You need something like a square kilometer of collecting area in order to make high signal-to-noise, high-resolution maps. So instead, what you want to do is you want to just be content with the things you can actually afford to observe, and you do statistical measurements of them. For example, you can calculate the power spectrum of the fluctuations on the sky in even a low signal-to-noise map. All right, and that's what I'm showing here. So this is K, so scale is increasing to your left. The solid curve here is the power spectrum we estimate for the 21-centimeter signal. And it has two contributions, basically. There's the density, which is this dotted curve. And the density is just the matter power spectrum that we all know and love from CMB and galaxy surveys. On top of that, though, there's the ionized fraction fluctuations. Okay, and that's the dashed curve. And you can see that, as I mentioned when we were looking at the map, this is really what dominates the statistics in the middle of reionization because there's such a strong contrast between the light and the dark. Right, so in our model, what happens is this increases out to some characteristic scale. That's the bubble size, the characteristic bubble size. And then it gently declines. So what you want to do is you want to measure where this peak occurs. And that's telling you something about the topology of reionization. As an example, here I projected that power spectrum onto the sky. So this is L mode number down here, as with the CMB. Right, and if you're early in reionization, then the ionized bubbles don't matter. The dotted curve here, it's just the density fluctuations, basically. As you go forward in time, the bubbles appear. They start out small, you get a little bump at small scales, and then that bump moves to larger and larger scales as time goes on. So you can measure the evolution of the topology, right? And that depends on, obviously, two things. One is that characteristic scale. If you go back to a model where the galaxies are isolated and things are happening on very small scales, then you get something like this blue curve, which peaks on much larger L mode numbers or smaller scales. The other thing is the contrast between the light and the dark. Okay, so if you have some X-ray background, for example, that's responsible for most of the ionizations, then you go from this pronounced bubble up here to this thick blue curve, okay, in which it's damped out quite a bit. Now, just very briefly, I've talked about the power spectrum here, and that's because that's the statistic that we're all most familiar with, because CMB and galaxy fluctuations are basically Gaussian, so this is a very good statistic. Obviously, when you add in the ionized bubbles, that's no longer true. We're not Gaussian anymore. So we need to actually look at better statistics. And this is something that we don't really know anything about yet. It hasn't been explored, I don't think. But it's clearly going to be important. And just as an illustration, this is a histogram of the fluxes you would get in pixels of a map, okay, if you had no noise. And just pay attention to this black dashed curve, which is what you would get if you ionize the lowest density regions first, right? And contrast it with this solid curve, which is what you get in the model that I described, where you're basically ionizing the highest density regions first. I've constructed these two curves so that the variance is within a factor of two of each other. So it might be hard to distinguish with just the power spectrum, But if you had this whole histogram, obviously, you know, these things are completely different. And that's why we need to develop better statistics. All right. So just finish with discussing whether these 21 centimeter measurements can actually be done. There's good news and there's bad news about these observations. The good news is, well, it both has to do with the fact that we're observing at 100 megahertz. The good news is it's really easy to build an antenna that works at 100 megahertz, right? Anything like it, you know, your headphones and headphones cord will work. Here's an example of what LOFAR is thinking about. It's basically just four, you know, metal pipes soldered together at the end and stuck in a field somewhere. Right? It's very, very cheap and easy. The bad news, though, is that at 100 megahertz, there are things like FM radios, stations, and cell phones, and televisions, and all these terrestrial noise sources. And you need to somehow separate those from the cosmic signals that you're interested in. And that's a challenging problem. And it's something that's only now becoming possible with the computers that we have right now. So basically what LOFAR is going to do is they're going to hook 16,000 of these things up to one of IBM's BlueJean machines, which is the fastest computer in the world right now, and just correlate the heck out of the data and get rid of all that terrestrial noise, okay, on the back end. So this is really, low frequency astronomy was, radio astronomy was popular in the 60s. And then it sort of petered out because of this interference problem. And now only now are we getting back to a point where we can do it again. So there are a whole bunch of, there are at least five groups who are working on experiments to do this kind of thing. I want to focus just on the Mollera Wide Field Array because that's the one that I'm most involved in. All right, so it's a collaboration between MIT and the CFA in the United States and Melbourne and ATNF in Australia. Okay, and we're going to put it in Western Australia, the reason being that you might as well get rid of as much of the radio terrestrial interference as you possibly can by going to some place where nobody lives. So here's Mollera. Perth is somewhere down here. And just to show you how radio quiet this thing must be, here's the site. There's a kangaroo. Okay, so it's going to be a 516-element antennae distributed in a 1.5-kilometer distribution. So this number is interesting. It gives you about arc minute resolution. And I'd like to tell you that that's, you know, perfectly designed for our theoretical models, because that's where things are interesting. You know, it is perfect for the models, but it's actually just about, you know, all you can afford, given the money that we're hoping to get. Submitted the proposal a few months ago. So this is really an economic thing right now. And in principle, you could just spend more money and get better resolution. For the kind of measurements we're talking about, there are two important things that you want to do. One is you want to make sure that you really understand the data that's coming in. And the reason is, in addition to the terrestrial interference, you have all these foregrounds from things that are extragalactic or galactic, but not your 21-centimeter signal. And you need to be able to reliably separate out those fluctuations from the fluctuations from high redshift. And so, you know, sort of the design principle that's guiding most of these experiments is to really understand your instrument well enough to calibrate out all those other sources of uncertainty. The second important quantity is we're making a statistical measurement, so you want survey speed to be maximized. All right, we're not trying to really make high-resolution images. We're just trying to measure the statistics. Okay, so that means that you want a big bandwidth in order to get large redshift coverage instantaneously. So we're talking 4 megahertz, which gives you about delta Z of a half. And you still have to sample really finely by radio standards because you need to get rid of the RFI, the terrestrial RFI. The total bandwidth of the instrument will go out to about 80 megahertz, which means we can go out to about redshifts of 16. So that gives you the radial direction. You also want to be really big in the angular direction. And the great thing about these dipoles is they can, in principle, see the entire sky. Okay, so it just matters as to sort of how you set them up and what kind of computing back end you have to determine your field of view. So we're realistically talking about fields of view that are hundreds of square degrees, up to 1,000 square degrees, depending on the frequency you're working at, which is just amazing to me. And with that huge field of view, even though your signal to noise per pixel is poor, you get so many pixels that you can make good statistical measurements. So here's an estimate of what we can do. This is from Miguel Morales. This is the solid curve is, again, just the density power spectrum. Okay, it's in different units. That's why it looks different. And then the points with error bars are what this instrument can do in 100-hour integration, neglecting some of the trickier data analysis issues. But there's a basic cut. This is how well we can do in a few days. Right? And you see that you make a pretty good measurement of that power spectrum pretty quickly. So we're quite hopeful that this is going to this and these other 21-centimeter experiments really can revolutionize the study of reionization. And here's my last slide. I hope I've convinced you that reionization is complex and inhomogeneous, not only, you know, as a time history, but at any one instant. And it's that complexity that's really carrying all the information about what's causing reionization and how it's happening. There are in a variety of different techniques that you can use to constrain that. And the most interesting part of it is they're all sort of at most 3-year timescales. If you compare that to when we're going to have good samples of galaxies at redshift 10, that's probably going to have to wait until JWST in 2012 or so. Okay, so in contrast to low redshift, where we have great samples of galaxies and are struggling to understand what they're doing to the IGM, at the redshift 10, we're going to hopefully have a great understanding of what's going on in the IGM, and we're going to have to invert that to figure out what the galaxies are doing, at least until JWST or something comparable flies. So I think that's an interesting problem that as theorists we need to solve, how to figure out that inversion and robustly interpret the results. And I'll end there. Thanks. So that's the you're talking about the clusters? That's the thermal SC. So the thermal SC has this frequency dependence where it cancels out at 217 gigahertz, I think. And so you observe the kinetic SC at that exact frequency where you can subtract it. You can safely ignore the thermal SC. In absolute magnitude, the thermal SC is quite a bit larger than the KSC contribution. And whether you can actually do that is another question. You need to be able to understand the frequency dependence of the of your foregrounds, basically, in order to make sure that that works out.
You know, perhaps I missed that, but when you were talking about 11 meters or 6.5 as a probable realization, you were putting them in some H2 region. Now, to do that consistently, you need to know what is the mass of those 11 meters to assess the cluster, right? So will you say anything about their property?
Yes, I did assume that. Well,
so let me show the plot here. How do we know what the mass? You were saying, you were giving a constraint of 50% organized fraction is equal to 6.5 based on that. That must depend on the mass.
Yeah, well, it does. So what I've done here is I basically scaled to the luminosity of a 10 to the 10 solar mass galaxy. All right. And then you have to connect this to the characteristic luminosity of the Malhotra-Rhodes observations. And that's where you don't know how to do it. But if you look at any one luminosity here, there's actually very little luminosity dependence in how the shape of the luminosity function is changing. So I don't think it actually matters. I mean, to the precision that I can say, it's less than 50% or so. I don't think it will end up, you know, changing that rough number. If you want to do it in detail, though, yeah, you need to understand where the luminosity function of Lyman alpha emitters comes from, and that's a very hard problem right now, I think.
Were you assuming that there was a constant of proportionality between the Lyman alpha emission and the ionizing emission?
No, I am.
So what?
I'm saying, okay. So in our basically, because of the way we constructed our model is a press sector variation, so you can construct the galaxy distribution in each bubble self-consistently from the model. Right, so I'm just distributing galaxies of particular masses in bubbles. And then I'm scaling everything to the luminosity of this kind of galaxy. Now, what would...
Wouldn't there be a natural zero-flutter model where you be constructing your press sector distribution of the ionized zones with that zeta? You may... The luminosity in Lyman alpha emitters depend on the same zeta.
Well, I've assumed here that the luminosity is proportional to mass, and so essentially I've done that. I've also looked at things where you make the luminosity proportional to mass to the 2/3. It doesn't really change the results.
Well, mass to 2/3.
Well, yeah. If you want it to mass to 0.1, then yes, it'll probably change, but. Yeah, I mean, so there have been a number of papers pointing out that if you, so you want to basically, with a 21 centimeter, look at the fluctuations across the sky and in frequency space. And if you calculate how rapidly the radio galaxies or clusters or free emission that we know of is fluctuating across the sky, it's actually about an order of magnitude stronger than the 21 centimeter part itself. But the thing that saves you is all of those foregrounds have either synchrotron or free spectra, which are smooth in frequency space, whereas you're looking at signal that's fluctuating. So basically what you do is you have some total bandwidth, and you specify that a number of channels are going to be used to subtract out the foregrounds. You take those measurements and just smoothly interpolate between them in each pixel, and that allows you to subtract out the smooth component that's coming from low redshifts, and you're just left with the high redshift signal. And my group and a number of other groups have estimated how well you can do that, and it looks like it's, you know, well, better than the instrument noise for this first generation experiments, at least. I don't think it'll be a problem. It's a computational challenge, though, so people still need to worry about how to do it.
What do you think the impact on the kind of predictions that you were showing, of this effect emphasized by Barkin and Loeb, or the gap between, or the absence of large-scale power in the finite box simulator?
That's what's basically, I mean, our model is very similar to what they were saying. We sort of quantify. You can basically redo this calculation, cutting off all the large-scale power like is done in simulations. And what ends up happening is by this point, you're a little bit off. And by this point, you're basically still here. So you're truncating. You're artificially suppressing the size of the bubbles in the latter half of reionization.
So that means so perhaps I can ask it then with regard to something like the power spectrum that you showed of the 21 centimeter in the presence of the reionization. How big a box do you need to accurately see the peak you were talking about in the power spectrum?
It depends on when during reionization you are. So if you want to study the last half of reionization, you need at least 100 megaparsec box, I would say. If you want to study this part, it doesn't really matter. 10 megaparsecs is fine. It's just the last half that you have to worry about.